This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 212 in the series. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio, WFPR.FM. The expected demographics study was presented during the school committee meeting on Tuesday, February 25, 2020. Expected? Yes. This is one key piece of the information that needs to be gathered and digested to enable the school committee and community to make a decision on what needs to be done to prepare for enrollment and facilities. The potential for closing the Davis Thayer School has been talked of off and on for several years. The work is now underway to look at that and what it would mean for the district and community as a whole. The demographic study presented, as I mentioned, is one key piece of the information needed for such a decision. As outlined by Superintendent Sarah Hearn at the end of the presentation segment, you'll hear, the second key piece is expected in or around April as the facility analysis arrives from that consultant. For our existing school facilities, what capacity do we have for students in each building based upon the current or anticipated requirements? The capacity report should provide the answer to that question. One could go back to look at when each building was built and look at what was designed for, but the educational requirements have changed considerably since then. Davis Thayer, for example, since it is the key item during driving the question, was built as a high school in the 1920s and is now being used as an elementary school. Along the course of the discussion, you'll hear James McKibben comment on space requirements. Note, this was not part of his charter. His was only to focus on the demographics. However, from his experience in working with other districts, he can say that due to special education requirements, the space, that is, square foot requirements per student, will be increasing. Pay attention to the assumptions. There are 19 of them. Mr. McKibben counts a couple as more critical than the others. The mortgage interest rate, for example, most would acknowledge as important. The lower it is, the more willing buyers will be. Of interest, though, is the amount of existing home sales required to maintain our population. Per his calculations, that's 275 existing homes selling each year. Forget about growth. Forget about the new stuff. 275 existing homes per year in order to maintain our population. The presentation doc he used is linked in the show notes so you can follow along. Clearly, there'll be more analysis and insights that'll be discussed over time as we all digest the numbers. So the discussion, since it runs about an hour and 10 minutes, without further ado, let's listen in so you can hear what's going on.
Okay. Our first presentation tonight is a demographic presentation from Jerome McKibben of McKibben Demographics. He is here to share an enrollment forecast for the district. He has about a 20-minute presentation, and he does ask that you hold questions until the end, because many of the questions that come up may be addressed as he proceeds. I want to extend my appreciation for Dr. McKibben and the work that he's done. It has been very, very informative, and I think that this will be an informative presentation similarly for those school committee members and folks in the audience.
Thank you, Dr. Ahern, Madam Chairperson, members of the board. Try to go through this in about 20 minutes and leave as much time for questions as possible. The first thing I'd like to point out, and Dr. Ahern mentioned this, these are forecasts, they are not projections. The difference between the two, at least in the field of demography, is very important. A projection is where you take a past trend for enrollment, usually year-to-year survivorship, second, third, third to fourth, over about 5-year period of time, create an algorithm, and then use that to literally project into the future. Very quick, easy, cheap to do. Up until about the mid-1990s, about all you had for enrollment projections. The problem with the projection is they're almost never correct. because the only way a projection can be right is what's happened over the last 5 years replicates itself over the next 5 or 10. A forecast, and this is a two-step procedure, first thing we do is a full population forecast for each one of your elementary attendance areas. Build a fertility, mortality, migration model specific to that area based on their demographic characteristics, demographic trends, and their dynamics. As a result of that population forecast, then drives enrollment forecast. So it's your current and future demographic trends, not what you've had over the last 5 years. And for Franklin, that turns out to be a very, very key factor as you're at a very important juncture in your demographic dynamics. Now, anytime you're doing a forecast, work button. Am I not doing this right? I'm out local with a medley of show tunes.
No, Dan is here.
There it is.
Oh, there we are. Thank you. Anytime you're doing forecasts, you have to have assumptions. These are broad socioeconomic demographic parameters, if you like, that we use in our assumptions going forward in the future, what's going to happen. I won't go through all of them. I do want to go through a couple of very key ones today. If these assumptions are not violated, we should be within 2% of the district total each year for the 10-year life of the forecast. Think of it as a confidence interval, just 2% band around it. And there's three very, very important ones. And probably the most important one is number two. The 30-year fixed mortgage rate stays below 5%. Why is that so important? It drives your housing market. Okay. Just last year, about 18 months ago, we saw the 30-year fixed rate go above 5% for the first time in 10 years. Home sales across the country, New England, Massachusetts, just rolled off the table. And then Jerome Powell started cutting interest rates. We're now back down about 4.2, and it's gone back up again. So it really affects the seller side of the buyer side of the market. You may have seen the article that came out just a few months ago where the average college graduate comes out of school with $40,000 student loan debt, which is true. But what the article didn't tell you is the average college graduate marries a college graduate, is $80,000 household debt. That's where the mortgage approval rate's only running about 62%. Unless you've got FHA, you got to have 10, 15, 20% down. So the younger generation today, most home buyers between the ages of 28 and 42 years old, very susceptible changes in the interest rates. And their ability to buy homes is very, very important. We'll get to the renters in a second. The second one, and this is specific to Franklin, it's number seven. The district has at least 275 existing family home sales in the next 10 years. That is the backbone of your housing market. Across the United States today, existing home sales make up 90% of the housing market. It's about 85% up here in New England, okay? As you go through, and you've got the data from the town on what's being built and planned and all that. Yes, it's wonderful, 700 new housing is going in. Get 2,750 in the next 10 years. Let me put it to you this way. You could build 2,000 new housing units in this town over the next 10 years. If you don't sell any existing homes, your population enrollment will drop. That's how important it is. This is a frequently overlooked factor when looking at demographic dynamics, and it's tied into your age structure. So this is a very, very key assumption. Right now you're averaging just a hair under 200 a year. It's going to be going up over the next 10 years, and I'll explain that in a bit why it's happening. But that's the key one, not so much building the new apartments, but existing homes. And these are usually homeowners. They're empty nesters. Probably had any children coming out of there for 15, 20 years. You'll start seeing kids coming out of housing units that you haven't seen kids come out of since maybe the 90s. So again, a very, very key factor. And then number 17, this housing turnover rate, existing sale of homes. Current levels, by that I mean rate, and mostly the majority of homeowners over the age of 60. Now, you'll see a slight uptick at age 62 for home sales, another one at 65, but most people don't downsize their homes till they're in their 70s. It's not retirement that drives downsizing. It's either the death of one of the spouses or both of them lose the ability to drive. House is too big, getting around the issue. Only 8 to 12% will snowbird to Florida or the Carolinas or whatever, and only about 8 to 12% go to assisted living. Most of them, when they move less than 50 miles, and if there's a bit housing available, they like to stay in the town they live in. They like living there. But it's a question of where they get that point in the life course. So that's, again, another assumption. Now, the number one predictive variable for future population change, it's not births, it's not deaths, it's not even migration. It's your age structure. How is your population distributed across the life course? And to show this, we look at something called a population pyramid. This is for the district as a whole. I have one for each one of your attendance areas, okay? And they're pretty easy to read. 0 to 4, that's your preschool. 5 to 9 is elementary, middle school, high school. 20 to 34 years old, we call family formation ages. 80% of all births occur between the ages of 20 and 34 years old. Despite what you've read in the popular press, fertility rates in this country have stayed in a nice tight 15% band for the last almost 50 years, between 1.7 and 2.0 children per woman in her lifetime. We use a resident total fertility rate here. You can have a total fertility rate of 9. If you don't have women in prime childbearing age, you're not gonna have that many births. So when you see a change in the number of births in the area, it's usually not due to a change in birth rate, but rather a change of women in prime childbearing age. You'll notice that in your population, you have a dearth. This is not uncommon. We call this the suburban model. The reason for this, the vast majority of your housing units are owner-occupied. You don't come out of college and buy a house. You come out of college and rent an apartment. Then you start your family. Then you buy a house. So areas that are majority owner-occupied tend to have this dearth in the 20s. And that's also why you have this dearth in the 0 to 4. Okay, 35 to 54 are the ages where most people have kids in school. There are exceptions to that. I was one of them. I was a first-time father at 40, okay? But most people are usually done by that point, okay? 55 through 69, we refer to as the empty nest households. This is where it gets a little confusing for people. The Smith family is still living in the same household they've been in for 15 years. But 10 years ago, there was 4 people in that household. Today, there's 2. And that's why we don't use the housing unit method for our population forecast. It doesn't have an out-migration component. It assumes that the household size stays the same. It doesn't. And your biggest out-migration flow is 18 to 24-year-olds. And then, of course, the 70 and over are what we call the turnover ages. Now, put this for a second. This is the 2010 census. Go forward 10 years, okay? Clearly, over the last decade, you've had an increase in the homes turning over. See that in your housing market. House goes up for sale in Franklin, it's usually sold in about 3 weeks, okay? But the number of households empty nesting is going up at a much, much faster rate, okay? So yeah, you do have turnover, but not enough to replace those who are empty nesting out. If you go from 2010 to 2015, if no one had moved into the district, you just left your own demographic devices, your elementary enrollment would have dropped by 1,000 students. Why? Because the cohort coming in behind it is smaller. Now it didn't, it only dropped by 600, which tells me you had 400 kids born between 2005 and 2009 move in over that period. That's very important. That's where we start building your age-specific migration model, okay? So it's kind of catching up this bar here. This is very, very common again in suburban areas. You don't have enough births in the town to maintain your enrollment at current levels. You need in-migration. And given this huge number of people, your biggest age group, 45 to 49, they're done having children. Now, those households are probably not going to produce any more kids for the school district. Well, they're now in their late 50s. As you're going forward in the next decade, you're going to see a faster increase in households turning over and a slowing of this number of empty nesters. Your new migrants moving in these age groups, bringing kids with them, okay? And that's your dynamic. So that you're basically at the bottom of the trough right now. From this point, you can see your enrollment would have dropped precipitously over the years, unless you had massive building to make up for the lack of turnover. Same situation we saw when we did the forecast in Westwood, Wellesley, Newton, Arlington. This is not just a Franklin issue. This is going on all over New England. And New England has the lowest total fertility rate in the country, around about 1.6 right now. Yours is actually, given the fact there's a small college in town, a little higher than you'd expect in an area like this, but it's still not enough. 2.1 is replacement level. So right off the bat, you're like a half a child short per household. We also refer to this as your demographic fingerprint, because no two areas have the exact size, shape, distribution of the population, which is why we do one for each one of the attendance areas. And of course, Davis Thayer is the one that stands out right off the bat. Why does it look like this? That's where the college is at. College students are counted where they go to school, not where they're from. So in the census numbers, you see this large number, but because of the people prime childbearing age, you don't see a whole lot of births because they're college students, don't come here to have kids or to go to school. Okay. If you go to Jefferson Davis, you start seeing this hourglass figure again, okay? And a huge deficit in the 0 to 4, and a large number going into high school. Very, very small number turning over, okay? Each area has its own different dynamic to it. Again, you have this hourglass for Keller, and again, relatively small number turning over, a lot more empty nesting, and also a very, very large deficit because there's so few people in prime childbearing age. Kennedy, again, same situation. And then Oak Street, a little less dramatic, tends to be a little younger population, not quite as much of a deficit, more people in the early 30s there. But again, largest number, 45, 49, now in their late 50s. And then finally, Parameter, I've been mispronouncing that the whole project. I keep wanting to call it Parameter, you know, so. Again, a much more even distribution, not as extreme, more people prime childbearing age, the smallest deficit. As it moved forward, it needs fewer households to move in to make up for that deficit. So how do these things interplay? Well, look at the key variables here. Even in 2010, only 43% of your households had under 18 population, which means there was only about 35% that had school age kids in it. There's not a school district in this country where the majority of the households have school-aged children. Last one was in Utah about 15 years ago. Not one left. And those percentages are dropping. Persons per household, the district's 2.8, but look at this wide range. You got 3.34 in Keller, all the way down to 241 in Parmenter. You know, so it's a wide, and that's a key variable because a real crude measurement. You got mom, you got dad, whatever the point is number of kids. So you have anywhere from 0.4 kids per household to 1.3. So again, these individual dynamics, each attendance area has a key impact on this. 35-54, again, 53%. These are the people who tend to have kids in school. You're now down about 45% right now. But the good news is householders over the age of 65 at 17% and going up since then. But again, a wide range from 11% at Keller up to 23% in Parmenter. Now, home owners versus renters, this is a very key variable. As I mentioned earlier, when you start, you know, getting in a college or moving to an area, you tend to get an apartment. Apartment dwellers tend to be younger, and because they're younger, they're poorer. That's where you start your family. Okay, so you have a lot of preschoolers in apartments. So the child per household and the school-age kids per household, very wide gap between the two, okay? And they move an average of every 2 years. homeowners, the other end of the spectrum, you've got condos and townhouses in between, but homeowners tend to be older, wealthier for that matter, have completed their family formation, so the number of kids per household, school age per household are pretty close together, and move an average every 13 years. So much more stable than to be an older population. So now while the district's about 80% owner versus renter, you've got four districts here that are all above 80%, and of course your two outliers, Thayer and Parmenter, where you have a larger number of rental properties. So you're seeing different dynamics going on in this area, and that ties into what's happened over the last 10 years, what's going to happen over the next 10 years. The trend is changing. Single person households, 20%, not surprising, and Thayer and Parmenter, where you have all the apartments, that's where you'd expect them. Percent single over 65, this is usually elderly households where one of the members have died and turn over very quickly. 7%, that's going up rather rapidly. And again, Parmenter is the one where you see the highest number in this. Now this is my favorite data from the 2010 census. It's the individual year of age count by school, okay? And we do this for one reason. One is to do research so we can start building your age-specific migration model, but also allows us to take what we call the cohort effect. You'll be in an area and people have trouble correlating real events to what's going on in the community around them. So if you see a large increase in first grade or kindergarten population area and you see some houses being built, it must be the houses causing that. My first thing is maybe a big cohort effect, because I know in most demographic variables, time is the variable that people forget. For example here, look at Oak Street, okay? Now, sixth grade or 6 year olds, 83, pops up to 102, drops to 86. Well, when that cohort hits school, you're gonna have a 20 increase 1 year and almost a 30 drop the next, just because it's a cohort, you know, just happens to be a big one going through. So you don't want to overgeneralize that trend or miscorrelate it to any other trend. But the other thing it also shows is in 2010, 5 year olds were your kindergartners. First grade, second, third, fourth, fifth, okay? Go forward 5 years, 2015, is under one are now five, their kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. And we can see what you should have done versus what you really did do. And look at the cohort sizes, 500, 500, 524, drops in the fourth, drops in the three. That's that depth that I keep talking about. So just to break even in a 5 year period from these under one getting up to 5 years old here, you need an increase of 220 kids born in the year 09 just to break even. This is why people say, I see all these households moving, I see all this stuff being built. Why is your enrollment going down? And they'll overgeneralize that too. Well, it's going down because there's more cohorts coming in. And as long as that situation persists, you're going to see a decline. And if the reasons for that small cohorts are continuing, you're going to continue to see a decline, which you did throughout the decade. You're at a point right now where the trends are starting to change. That's another point of analysis. So what we do here with this data is we do something called the market share, and I've got a district level example next, okay? We compare your actual enrollment 2014, your kindergarten that year were 1 year old in 2000 census. We calculate a percentage, and we track them through time. They're first grade, now they're second, third, fourth, they're fifth graders this year. And we look at the change in the percentages. And if you look at these in virtually all the cases, they go up, okay? And that allows us to measure the amount of in-migration by age cohort, age-specific migration model, into the area with your home sales and your home construction. And from that, you can then generalize an age-specific migration model. But I've learned over the years that when a third grader moves, in most cases, they take the whole family with them. Not always, but in most cases they will, okay. Also, you'll see when you get to ninth grade this year, the percentages drop because you have a drop from the students leaving your eighth grade, not going to public high school, schools in the area. That's pretty consistent over time. But in most of these, particularly the elementary ones, you're seeing, you know, sustained fairly strong in migration. It's not a question that people don't want to move here. It's just not enough homes on the market. That's the problem right now. Now, all of this information goes into called the population forecast, calculated for each area. This is the total. I'm going to use this as an example of how to read it. There's two ways to follow this. You can look at age group over time, 5 to 9 year elementary. It goes from 26 to 21 to 18 to 17, starts going back up. Or follow a cohort through time. 1900 becomes 21, 22, because you have people that move in that are late elementary, middle school kids. Drops a little bit, 15 to 19, because you start having seniors going away to college, and then really drops off to 2024. Franklin is suffering from what I refer to as the curse of the successful school district. What is the curse? Well, very high graduation rate, very high college participation rate. I think it's like 85% right now, 87, something like that. They go on. So they graduate, you know, good grades, good test scores, you know, supportive community, board, administration. They graduate, go off, and they don't come back. For every two high school seniors that graduate and move away, you need one new household to move in, just replace their lost fertility. And it's a great way to test this theory. This year, the classes of 15, 10, and 05 are having their 5, 10, 15 year reunions. Go to the reunions, talk to the alumni, and see how many of them still live in the district. If it's 20%, you're doing real well, probably closer to 15. And that is going to persist as your participation rates stay high. Median age, 38, keeps going up to about 45. That's the point where half the people are older than that age, half are younger. Once your median age gets above 40, that means you're probably going to have fewer people in prime childbearing age. This column here, we call the components of change between the two periods, 10 to 15, 15, 20, 20, 25, and so on. The births stay relatively constant. Birth rate's constant, so is the number of women in prime childbearing age. But the deaths go up. In fact, it goes up almost 50%. Not because there's a plague here or coronavirus or anything like that. You just have more people we refer to in demography as being in prime dying ages. I know we gotta find a better term than that, but I used to refer to prime dying age as anybody over the age of 60, but now that I'm 64, it's anybody over the age of 80. So, but what it does, you'll notice your national increase goes negative. That, by the way, is the demographic trend of the United States for the next at least 15, 20 years. Have more deaths than births. The backbone of population growth this country throughout its history has not been foreign immigration, some would have you believe. It's been natural increase. We already have four states with more deaths than births: West Virginia, Rhode Island, Maine, and Vermont. We have 800 counties that are at ZPG or worse now. So that's one reason why your population growth slows down. Net migration, people go, well, there's more than 300 people moving in those 5 years. You're right, there is. It's the net migration. You get about 2,300 moving in, and most of your in migration is people between the ages of 28 and 45 years old and 0 to 9. Most of your out migration is 18 to 24 year olds and over 70s. Okay, you don't see a lot of the out migration because due to that reduction in household size. Same house, same family, but instead of four people, there's now two. You know, so you don't see a lot of out migration. And then, of course, there's the population change. All of this goes into driving each area's enrollment forecast. Okay. Here's where it gets a little complex because you're at a turn of the change in all this. So the first thing you have to introduce is the cohort effect. And the analogy I use is a bucket of water. Okay. If I have a bucket of water, and I'm pouring water at the top, and there's a hole in the bottom, as long as I'm pouring in faster than it's going out, the bottom level will rise. But if for some reason the hole in the bottom gets bigger, and it's now going out faster than I'm pouring in. If I'm pouring in the same rate, the level will drop. And enrollment works the same way. What's at for district level, what's the size of the K-1 cohorts coming in? What's the size of the 12th grade cohorts going out? Okay. And at the in elementary level, it's what's coming in K-1, what's going out in grade 5. Note that over the last, well, 3 years I've listed here, but going back throughout the decade, most of your 12th grade classes have been far above 400. In fact, the larger the 12th grade class is, the more decline is the next year, okay? Relatively stable moving in. You got first grade cohorts of about 300. By the way, you're averaging about 200 births, so that tells you how much you're gonna make up, hence the decline. Now, as you go forward, you've got about 4 or 5 more years of 400 plus 12th grade classes graduating out. You'll notice I actually got your K-1 going up a little bit because you're gonna start seeing not only some of the building going on right now, but after 2024, you're gonna start seeing more and more households turning over, empty nesters moving out, new young households moving in. And it's at that juncture, you start seeing a slight increase in the K-1 enrollment, but also coincides with the 12th grade cohorts being below 400. You don't have to have as many come in to make up for your losses. Hence, you see that curvilinear trend. You have a little wave going through your enrollment. So if you look at the elementary, K-5 goes from 2085, the dearth is about 1920, and then it starts going up. In fact, it goes up almost 200 students. Combination of the fact that you don't have to replace large 12 or 5th grade cohorts, and you've got larger K-1 and even some increase in 2 and 3 coming in. So it's that curve and the trend. But that wave's still going through, and it gets all the way through middle school grades by about 2027. You see precipitous drops through that. But then as the cohorts start evening out, again, it turns about 2027 as they're aging through and starts going back up. Now, unfortunately, it's gonna take the whole 10 years for that wave to get through your high school with big cohorts until the big ones start coming back in, and that's all decline. So even, this is where it really gets confusing. I think people, they would see the district total dropping by almost 600 students, something rolling off the table, but almost all that decline is in high school. Little bit in middle school, the elementary starts going back up. So you've got three different dynamics going on at the same time. That's why if you look at your table 5 in your report, you see this 8% drop, you know, over the next 5 years, but an 11% increase as that trend turns upwards. You're getting rid of the large cohorts going on in middle and high school. You have growing cohorts coming in K-1. Now, what can go wrong on this? Plenty, okay? The big thing is we go into deep recession, interest rates spike. I'll tell you right now, if we come back in 2024 and the 30-year fixed rate 6-7%, I'm gonna be too high. That's gonna drive the housing market. These people need to be able to sell their homes, and the new young people need to be able to get a mortgage and buy them and come in, okay? That's probably the most dangerous one right now. But overall, because the 10-year trend is actually an increase in the enrollment. So this is particularly challenging for schools when you have a precipitous decline over a 10-year period, continuing for about, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 more, and then a pretty significant turn going after 2025. Now you'll notice here that you've got 3 schools, Jefferson, Keller, and Kennedy, looks like they're rolling off the table here, okay? Or how could it possibly cause this? Well, the other ones are going up a little bit. Well, I already gave you the answer. I'll show you the example here as I go through the individual ones. It's that cohort effect, okay? You look at Thayer, and this is my favorite one. It's stays actually starts going up, but there's this real tiny cohort right now in second grade on 23 students. When it graduates out, okay, in 2022, you're only losing 23, you got like 43 coming in, 17 increase. It looks like this huge percentage term spike is just one big year of a small cohort going out, okay? And it stays relatively, you know, modest after that. So that five-year change is basically explained by one year of a very, very small cohort. That's why you just can't take a single year. One year does not a trend make, I like to say. It's, you look at the whole picture, you know, plus and minus all the variables. You know, people will always pick out one or two or three variables, and they're always right. They're always factors you need to look at. The problem is there's like 15 or 20 to consider, some positive, some negative. Okay, Helen Keller, big drop off for 3 years. Why? You got three big cohorts coming out, but once those stop and drop below 50, it gets modest, and once it's in the 40s, and you start seeing a turn in the cohort sizes coming in because of new home construction and, more importantly, existing home sales, it levels out, starts going out. So I'm going to get repetitive here, because any place you have big cohorts going out, you see drops for about 3 to 5 years, but once they stop, here's a 39 coming down off of a 73, you know, that's what, 34 students less you have to make up for. Not surprisingly, the trend's going to turn. Same thing with Thomas Jefferson. You see the drops, and once you start seeing small cohorts, it's going to level out and start going up, as long as the housing market holds up. Oak Street, which does not have they've already had their big cohorts go out the last couple 3 years. They're already back down in the 50s, hence a much more modest rate and slight upturn maybe a little earlier. So again, it's looking at each elementary's own distribution, population, what their demographic characteristics are, that's going to dictate what the future enrollments are. But again, in conclusion, I want to emphasize a very, very key point. This is really hinging on what your housing market does, not so much the new construction. That's going to help you for the next 5 years kind of soften this blow. What's really going to change the trend is your empty nesters over the age of 70 turning over their households, particularly after the year 2024. That is the key assumption right there. 24 minutes, that wasn't too bad on that. So it's probably this old college professor's, once you just go and you can't shut us off. So
questions? Comments?
I do have a question, okay? I'm just processing.
Sure. It's a lot of data to comprehend.
It's a lot of data.
Once.
It's really great, really well done, and
thank
so
you.
Thorough. Thank you for doing that. For those of us that don't look at this all the time, though, it's like a lot at once.
Well, just on that point, when I did this presentation at Westwood 5 years ago, I ran out of town for being so pessimistic. We just did their fifth year evaluation. That was 50 too high. So there's two things I've never heard in my 30 years of doing this. I do a presentation, and the first one is, you know, I think this guy read the money. I think he nailed it. And the second one I've ever heard is, gee, Dr. McKibben, you think your forecast might be too high. I'm always wrong and I'm always low. So I'm used to it. So.
Okay.
Sorry to throw you off your thought train there, but.
No, that's okay. I just have some questions, and they're sort of.
I can go back to the slide you want.
So I guess all the judgment factors that you used were the ones that you had talked about at the beginning, right?
The assumptions, yeah.
So the assumptions the same as the factors, is that the same thing?
Or do you have additional factors?
Because you had the data.
Yeah. Unemployment rates in there too. I went over the big ones that are most likely. Everything currently planned, platted, approved, and permitted is being built. If it's speculative, it's not in there. I learned a long time ago not to put it in. We're thinking about doing this. Well, when you're through the process, let me know, we'll put it in. We had the same argument in Brookline a couple weeks ago. Someone was thinking about doing a housing addition. And they said, well, let me know when you got underway, we'll put it in. Until then, it's just pie in the sky.
Gotcha. Because I think there's definitely some rumblings of that here, and it's not official on the books yet. But So how much would that change or skew this? How dramatically?
Not much.
Okay. Like you say, it's a charm for a single family.
I'm more worried about that number right there. That's the number you should be worried about, mm-hmm. too. I should go a little bit depth on that, too. We use Zillow and RealtyTrack. We get home sales, we got it back to 2009, get down to parcel level. People don't realize everything about your house is public domain data. So we buy their data, but you get on there, you get little free promos, you can see what's been sold, how long it's been on the market, its price history, price cuts, if any, on there, how, you know, anybody want to. Both do foreclosures and sales. Zillow is better for sales, RealtyTrack is better for home closures or for foreclosures. Anybody ever use RealtyTrack? Go home tonight, type in realtytrack.com, one word, and you get a little free promo. You type in your address, and it'll pop up like a mile radius, and you can see who all your neighbors are, friends and neighbors are behind on their mortgages. Great way to spice up next cocktail party. You know? It's all out there. You'll see pre-foreclosed, behind on payment. It's juicy stuff out there, folks. But we can get it down to the parcel level. And this is why we can do this now. So we have all this GIS data. We can get things, we can get anything we want down the parcel. We always had the methodology to do this. We just had the data. Well, now we just got treasure trove. We got census data down the block levels. You know, we got admin records, most New England towns, Franklin's the same way. Great GIS website, you know, it's all sorts of just good data. So we incorporate everything we lay our hands on. But so we know that your home sales market's very, very strong. Goes on the market, it's gone. But 125 and you need about 300. So that's the problem right there. And we can localize that between your attendance areas. So.
It's fascinating. There's one question about the total enrollment chart.
Mm-hmm.
This one. So the.
Oops, that one there.
Yeah, the, on the very top row, the pre-K is like just steady at 100.
Oh, yeah. We have 111 pre-K students because that's what you get space for. Not demographically
driven. So it's filled to capacity.
Right. If you had funding, space, personnel, all those stuff for 180 pre-K students, you'd have 180. Okay. That's not due to any rise or drop in your population enrollment. So we always hold pre-K constant because it's more program and administrative factors that constrain that. Now, if Sarah called up and said, we're going to expand our pre-K to 150 next year, you'll have 150 kids in there, mm-hmm. okay? Or you're going to expand to full day, you know, it's going to have an impact. We can put that in, but under your current parameters, there's no reason it's not any demographic factors going to change. It's going to be all administrative. So that's pretty common in most school districts, unless they're going to make some kind of predetermined change in how they're going to deliver pre-K. It was the same thing with kindergarten back when it was all half day. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw a lot of kids that parents, they wanted full day kindergarten for a host of reasons. So it was a lot of fluctuation. Whenever they went to full day and they have a staff, they could handle the same cohort size as their first grade was, it went up. That's what's holding back your pre-K now. So.
Okay, even if we're legally required to provide special ed services for any student that has a disability over the age of 3, and then we have to have a certain ratio of peers not on IEPs, is that still?
Only if you've got space personnel for it, then if your special ed population is going up and you only got space personnel for 111, then that means non-special ed preschoolers are going to be not served. Because you're going to have room to put them in, and they have much higher square foot requirements for that, especially trained teachers. You know, there's a lot of factors in there. I got a 60-year-old brother with cerebral palsy. I had to deal with this stuff my entire life. A whole family has been experts in this field. So, we know how that works. So,
I can maybe add a little bit of Franklin-specific detail. You know, we certainly meet the expected ratios in terms of students who need the services per their IEP, and then peers from the community. And we do have a little bit more capacity at our preschool. If you look back in previous years, it had been slightly higher. I do think that one of the things that is, before I move on from that thought, so we do have a little bit more capacity, but we are meeting the requirements based on those expectations. I think one of the things that's kind of limiting our preschool enrollment are the hours, where families need longer hours, and so they're pursuing private pre-K. We've had some conversations with ECDC, we've had some conversations with Lifelong Learning. Solutions becomes a little bit trickier to manage at the preschool level, but it is something that we've been mindful of and discussing and talking about. But I think that keeps the numbers naturally around that 100 mark. Otherwise, we would see...
These were the same issues we saw in the 80s and 2000s with kindergarten, you know, expansion and all that, which is now deemed acceptable. And that's going to be the issue in the 2020s, is the expansion of pre-K. You know, it's already an issue in the political field now. It's just very expensive. And then the other factor, and to his personal knowledge too, the cost per child for special ed is much, much greater than it is for any kind of traditional student. So, you know, there's much more factors at work. It's going to be more complex, I think, than the move to universal kindergarten. Universal pre-K is going to be a much, much rockier road. And unless they start ponying up the money for it, it's going to vary from area to area. A lot of school districts throughout the country are going to dedicated pre-K buildings. That's one of them. And there's another set. We want each school, parents would like that better enrollments at each individual school. It may not be functional because of the building requirements to it. So it becomes a very complex problem. But the big thing is when you see changes that number, given that only less than a third of the cohorts in pre-K right now, it's not any kind of demographic factor that's going to change it. It's going to be administrative and service delivery factors that's going to change it. So unless you know something specific, my philosophy, unless you know something's going to happen, don't put it in there. So now, sit there and say, well, we plan to expand our pre-K by 20 students per year over the next 10 years. You can put that in there. Now, whether that happens or not, it's have nothing to do with the demographics.
Do you ever plot these on a graph visually? Because, like, I think your eyes are so well trained, you can sort of see the patterns. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But if it's like, if some of the, would we see a curve like this?
If you graph it, yeah.
Yeah.
It, my GIS people love to graph things. I'm a numbers guy, so.
But in these ones, especially the school by school, probably.
Yeah, the different ones. You see that curve or wave in it. It'd probably be easier. That's why I like the pop pyramids too. It's a lot easier than trying to read that.
Yeah.
You know, this makes perfect sense to me. Everybody's going, you know, like that. But seeing the population pyramid, it's a lot easier to read, make more sense. That's probably a good point. It's, I'll think about that for after 2020 census, but, it's the old prof in me. I'm still trying to terrorize students, you know. So, but that's a good point. Yeah, you can probably see that curve line easier, and you probably also see the fact that you've got different trends going on at the high school level, middle school level, and the elementary level. I think probably even more key point on that one. Because
right.
If you look at just the district total, you're going to misread this entirely.
Right. Well, the average takes way out.
And of course, I've been doing this for years. Nobody reads my population stuff. They all go to this thing first, you know, and they look at this, and then maybe they'll look at that later, you know. But that's where the action's at.
But
this is what drives the other one, so.
Yeah, just look at this stuff. Jen,
just a question.
So I'm reading the narrative piece in the report, and it said that it's about a 2% plus or minus.
2%.
So looking at all those assumptions, so when I look at all your assumptions, that makes me nervous, because that's a lot of things that need to kind of line up for the things to be within 2%. So you said the one that you're most concerned about is the housing, the 275 annual house sale?
Yep, that's
so
the one right
what
there.
What impact, and I don't know if you can kind of judge this or not, what impact would we see on the accuracy of your forecast if that indicator was one that was skewed and we weren't making that 275? Because I know, like, right now there's only about 10 or 12 single family homes on the market, right?
Right now, well, this is the dearth of the market.
Right,
it's
but I'm just
going
saying,
up. This is an annual number, so. Yeah. If you don't start going up precipitously in like April of this year, something happens, something like that, and you don't see the normal, because most people buy their homes between April and August.
Yep.
That's over two-thirds of your housing market right there. So you do not see the rise this year. And I probably should mention this, for all of our forecasts, for all of our districts, we've done it for years, I will call Sarah next fall, and she will send me your enrollment by grade for the district, school by total. We do evaluations, and we sit there and track, and we'll look at your home sales, what the interest rates were, the unemployment rate was, and any variable we lay our hands on, the next year to 2000 census too, 2020 census, and we do this evaluation and track, okay, has this been violated? And if it has been, like say one of the building projects we have in there did not come to fruition, you know, or it came on faster, we'd be higher, lower down. So we're going to track this for 3 years and see how we're doing.
So that's what I'm kind of asking. So if that, like number seven, because that's the one you said you were kind of most concerned
right.
about. So if that was to kind of alleviate from
right.
the 275, what kind of impact would that have on the forecast, percentage-wise, give or take? Because I know there's a built-in 2% margin.
Yeah, well, if you're down, well, if you're like 260 should be that much of a difference. If it's only 220, if I look at your housing numbers
yeah.
next September, from when I did the forecast, and you're running about 200, then I should probably be way too high.
Okay.
Conversely, if it's up around 310 or something, surprise, everybody just says, I'm tired of having my deduction capped at $10,000 on my taxes, I'm just gonna leave the state or something, which is, they won't happen, but say it did, I should be too low. So it's, again, the farther you deviate from that trend line, the more it should impact that. Or conversely, the interest rates spike,
right.
you know. And that's actually the one I'm more worried about. You're, I hate to be blunt about this, but with the elderly, over the next 10 years, you've got, basically you have two options. You either get older, you're gonna die, you know.
Exciting.
And they're not gonna live forever,
yeah.
you know. So, and that's the hard part, because we are seeing the age of when people are downsizing been creeping up the last 4 or 5 years. And one of the big reasons is because there's an absolute dearth of elder housing around here. And what is here is not cheap. You know, downsizing only moves to go someplace smaller, less maintenance, and cheaper. You know, now if someone comes in and builds 100, you know, modestly priced retirement units or something, that actually may be more beneficial for you than building single family attached homes, because it brings those homes on the market. But I need to track that over time. So if these variables happen, that's what I'm looking for. Should it be high? Should it be low? Should it be tracking right on?
So this update, so you would do an update in September?
No. Updates cost money. yeah. We'll do an evaluation and see how we're doing. If we're with the 2% band, we're good.
Okay. But anything outside of that 2% we would look at.
We'll talk.
Okay. And then, and I'm not sure if this is impactful or not.
Okay.
Obviously, this is 2010 consensus.
2020 census.
Yeah. So what is that? Does that play a factor into it? Because it's 10-year-old data?
No.
No?
You have to have some place to start. You have to have it like balancing your checkbook. You have to have an opening
so
balance.
So it doesn't, it's not as the, as yeah. the years kind of,
right, as it goes along? Not my
yeah.
numbers. When you get DeMar, if you know what he's doing, you know, that's great. You know,
right.
if you have someone that doesn't know what they're doing, you're in bad shape. Now, the 2020 census, when it comes out, and for no, it should be April or May of 21 when Massachusetts gets their results out. The redistricting stuff for elections comes out in January. But the full data set doesn't come out until April or May. That gives us a once a 10-year opportunity to do an evaluation on our population forecast. So I would then go back and see how close I am on these numbers, and get an extra evaluation on that one. Okay, are you really going to have 32,800 people? Okay, and then moving forward, we'll then get new population, because the piece of information I'm most interested in from the 2020 census first thing I'm going to look at is, stop that, how big's that deficit? Okay. Because fertility rates, although they don't have that much of an impact, they've been dropping, and you got fewer people here in prime childbearing age. Remember, pull the college kids out of there. You actually got fewer 2024s, and this bar is actually probably quite a bit shorter. I'm looking at how much deficit you're going to make up for. That's going to help with new calculations and all that. So it's a great time to do an in-depth evaluation. So we've already got 80-some school districts on the list for fresh forecasts right when the new census results come out, because of that very reason right there.
Judy? On your page, the elementary enrollment K through 5.
The total one?
2019 to 2029. Page 14.
That one there?
Yeah. Okay, we have 6 elementary schools. I know this is only a forecast, but do you see anything based upon your figures and your calculations that we need more than 6 elementary schools?
I don't have your capacity numbers. I can't answer that. When we do redistrictings, that's one of the variables we look at, is how much excess space do you have?
If we just do it based upon the number of students, if we had 5 elementary schools, mm-hmm. based upon the forecasted projection of the number of K through 5 in these schools, can 5 schools handle this projection?
I have no idea until I see the capacities.
Okay.
If take 2029, okay, divide that, or take this one, divide it by 6, okay, you're roughly looking at about 300 kids per school, going up to about, I don't know, 350. If your average building capacity is 450, probably keep all 6. If it's 600, you start looking at it. But I think the point to remember is you're going to start going back up after 2024. Okay.
Well, what I did, I took the school with Kennedy with the highest percentage deficit, 16.2, of that 10-year period.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only 57 students less.
Mm-hmm.
And I took Davis there from going up 18.5%, and that was only 42 more students. And then I took the bottom district total from 1974, to 2029, 2008, and that's only 34 students. I mean, unless I'm reading this wrong.
No. We'll put to you this way. Most of our work in the South and the Midwest and up here in the Northeast is closing schools. Closing schools. One of our company models is we've closed more schools than a 3-foot snowstorm. Okay.
I don't know if you want to have that as your motto for you.
Oh, I don't know about that. It's I stood in front of the ASBO meeting in Indiana 10 years ago and said you're going to close 40 high schools, 30 middle schools, or 80 middle schools, 120 elementaries in the next 10 years, and got ran out of the state. They just closed their 44th high school just last year. There's a whole bunch of factors at work here. There's two things, being a Scotsman, I don't like to do, and one of them's waste money, but the second one is, I won't tell a school district to build a school unless I'm absolutely 100% sure they're gonna need it. Conversely, I've seen how closing schools can tear up a community. And I've also seen them have to wring the hands and have open things back up 5 years later. So, pardon the expression, ladies, you know, before I'm going to recommend closing school, I'm going to be damn sure I got my numbers right. And I want every piece of information I lay my hands on, and I will not speculate on it at all. I will not speculate, tell a district to spend $60 million on a school. I will not speculate on them saying you should close a school, you know. Have your numbers straight, and it's got to be rock solid, because you're going to get massive pushback no matter which way you go. And trust me, I've seen enough of them the last 10 years. My hair wasn't always as gray. You know, I had dark hair one time in my life, and I started doing this for a living. But you're doing this right now, you're doing your due diligence, You're learning your demographic dynamics. You're learning there's all these factors you need to look at. And you look at them in toto, okay? Then you make a decision. But the one variable missing here, why I can't answer your question, I don't know your capacities. I don't know what shape your buildings are in. One thing I do know for sure is your square footage per child will go up the next 10 years. Why? Because it's done nothing but go for the last 30 years. Special ed is one of the big reasons. That number is going to go up. So you will put a little margin of error in there. Trust me, Wellesley had a lot of hand-wringing before they finally decided to pull the trigger on closed schools.
Okay. I would just interrupt. I was thinking in terms of the work that the committee's doing. It seems that this data is what you're going to be looking at. You're going to be looking at capacity. You're going to be looking at data. You're going to look at special ed needs. That's the work of this committee, is to take, which I think is pretty powerful data, you know, sort of beautifully laid out for us. But it's the work of the subcommittee to then take this data, given all the capacity of the building, the age of the building, the condition, and particularly the special needs and the space we're going to need. It's a hard-working committee, but it seems to me that down the line that's going to be a big part of the work that you do based on this data, that we're not ready to make any decisions yet, but we have to look at this as an important first step in
good point.
Altogether, so.
And that's why I think when the 2020 census comes out, to your point, ma'am, if this deficit's even bigger, it may take more than 275 homes per year being sold to make up for that deficit and turn your trend, okay? There's a lot of things to be considered at this point.
I think too, also just the fact, it's interesting data when you look at the middle school population going down too, and you know, it's so complex in terms of looking at all the data, you know, to see the drop there and what that might mean, and you know, it's going to be a lot of work. So to make sure, as you said, we have to do it right and make sure that we're, you know, dotting every. I thought you were done. I'm sorry.
Well, one of my major concerns, one of a number of them, is that this is Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, a town has to have a certain percentage of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
And Franklin has been lucky. We've got up to 12%. But now we're only a little bit over 10.
Mm-hmm.
Drops the old 10, any builder can come in and put a housing development anywhere they want in this town. And the town can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
The town can't stop it. Plus, there's another development that's not been approved yet, but it's coming up on 140. There's another big 18-plus acres of land downtown Franklin that has just been bought by two real estate moguls to do something in. And sure as shooting, someone's going to put a real estate contingent in that. And I'm just afraid that it's all make-believe. We're all just hoping that all of these things are going to fit in. This is going to work, and this is going to work, and this is going to work, and it's all puff and mirrors.
All that building you just talked about, that's rounding error. When I moved to Massachusetts 25 years ago, we wound up building out in Gardner. A couple of reasons. One, it's the place we could afford. We're starting college professors. But I watched firsthand how much fun it is trying to build something in Massachusetts. There's a reason why the New England area has the lowest home construction rate of anywhere in the country. You've regulated it to death. They may come in here and not. You want to stop a building addition? Call up the EPA. They'll be stopping their tracks. Again, I'm not worried about your building. That'd be a nice little extra plus. You know, it's going to have to be affordable. You know, goes back to that 270. Your young lady right there is more on track. That 275, that's the one you need to watch. You know, they can build 40, 50 new units a year in here. If you only have 110 existing sold, now you're going to make up for it. You know, you look at both variables at the same time. They tend to work in tandem with each other, inversely with each other, which is why I strongly suggest everybody keeps track on your monthly building numbers. And you don't see that turn in April going up, that's a red flag you need to be looking at.
Lisa.
Going back to what Judy was saying earlier in your answer about opening a new school, closing a school, sort of a dramatic recommendation like that, and you were saying you don't do that unless the data is very clear.
Rock solid.
So looking at like your IC patterns in this data, it takes a longer time to sort of uncover. So does this data give you any clear message either way, or are there too many factors that are uncertain?
Well, when I got them done, the first thing that popped into my head was your high school. You're going to see a 400 student drop in your high school, rock solid. And that's kids that already live in the district. They don't have to move in or move out. They're already here. They just, you know, age through, you know. So you're going to have excess capacity at your high school. You know, and that's causing a lot of school districts to rethink the way they deliver middle school, high school education. So you run them differently. But that's a, you know, can you handle a 400 student drop? Mm-hmm. How much extra space will I leave in your high school?
I think what a lot of the data are sort of telling us too is that this isn't, you know, we went into this thinking about one particular school, Davis Thayer, mm-hmm. and this, the data are uncovering all these other things. You know, mm-hmm. Car Mentor is going to be getting bigger and is already probably near capacity now. And so there are these other sort of patterns that are happening within the data that I think are important for all of us to keep in mind, that it's more than just
I've never been into Thayer, but in my field research here, I couldn't help but notice that it's older than dirt, you know. So, and it's much older than the rest of your schools. It's pretty, even to my eye, you can see that. So I can see what's, it also seems to be your smallest school too. So I can see where there would probably be other considerations out there about size, age, how much it would cost to renovate it, bring it up to specs for Bay State regulations. Again, these are those myriad of variables you have to look at all at one time. Much as I love to say that demography tells you all, it's just a piece of the puzzle, and it must be looked at in conjunction with other factors. So when we do redistricting, when we do school closings, when we do district mergers, which we're doing a lot of in the Midwest right now, we'll talk with an architect. You know, we'll talk with ed specs people. We'll talk to the administration, talk to the public, and all that, and kind of get all these factors together. So
and those are, as part of the subcommittee, we're working on all those other pieces. So again, it's important to know that this information is so rich and interesting, and there are other things, you know, after the 2020 census comes out, we'll be so sure about certain numbers, mm-hmm. But this is a piece of a bigger puzzle, right. So we're looking forward to trying some of the other pieces.
If you even hint about closing the school, you have parents out there printing up t-shirts and all that, and you know, it's we've seen the whole thing. When I retire, I'm going to write a book of things I've seen at school board meetings.
But it's we got to just stay. It's such an emotional thing because it really becomes family and home. And it's a tough thing. It's tough for us, and that's why the diligence of this committee and really looking and working so hard and looking at all the factors is so important. So, anything else? Oh, go ahead, Denise. I'm sorry. It's evening.
So it seems like the average fertility rate is a major factor along with the housing.
Mm-hmm.
So how does our average fertility rate of 1.63 compare to similar districts in the area?
Well, actually, it's resident total fertility rate, TFR. Total TFR is the number of children a woman has in her lifetime. I'm looking at residents. If you have a child someplace else and you bring it into the district as a migrant, that's migration. Now your personal TFR might be 2, okay? But your resident TFR, what you got here, might be 0, okay? So the fact you've got a small college here and they don't have that many births, 169 actually is pretty good. It's comparable to your neighbors. But again, in Massachusetts, about 1.6 to 1.65 across the state. In Boston might be closer to 1.8 or something like that, but it's all very low. It's not a replacement level. So just giving your own demographic devices, you don't have enough women in prime childbearing age and not having enough kids. And the reason why New England and Massachusetts is so low is close reason I'm not gonna go into that, but it's female workforce participation, education level. Massachusetts particularly, but New England has highest female education level and highest labor force participation. Most women want to wait till they get done with their schooling before they start. My wife was one, I don't have any kids till I get my doctorate done. Well, I was 34. Okay, well, we're going to have one. You know, that's about it. If you start at, you know, late 20s, early 30s, you're more likely to only have one or two. If you start at 18, 19, 20, more likely to have four or five. So it's those are the variables you can look at on at the TFR. If you wonder what a 0.6 kid looks like, go out to Ohio State. They have a lot of them out there. So that's the Bowling Green graduate, so.
I have one more question.
Sure.
So does this take into effect if there was an increase in taxes, which may drive out the elderly population and make room for more families with school-aged children?
Again, as a former
very general question.
As a former Massachusetts resident, can your taxes get any higher? You know, it's in fact, if the taxes go up, that might just drive out the elderly, might drive out everybody, you know. Expensive in moving is something called in migration called push-pull theory. You have to something to push out, you're to a push factor, it can be pulled someplace else. You know, so if you pushed out, where are they gonna go? You know, which states has to go out of the state. Well, you know, you have to change a job, you have someplace to go, it's cheaper, lesser taxes. Having moved from Massachusetts to South Carolina, I can say, yeah, my taxes are a lot lower. So are my level of public services, which is why my son went to private school down there. But mm-hmm. not go to South Carolina public schools. It's as long as you understand. Yeah. I can't go home again now, but you know, you get a look at, I get a myriad of factors in there. It wouldn't help. It would help pull people in, that's for sure. I'll give you that one, but I don't know if it's going to really push them out.
This was very helpful, I think.
Thank you.
Solid information, other than the, you know, over 60 mortality discussion.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
It was very helpful, and it's going to give us a lot of, again, first step, right? There's a lot of work to be done, no decision made based on this, but it helps, so.
Well, if any additional questions do come up, Sarah knows how to get a hold of me. I have a home, but I'm never there, but she can call me up on where I'm at. I got to fly to Detroit tomorrow morning, and it's kind of iffy right now. So, but after that, please don't hesitate to contact. And I will be in touch after your fall enrollment data set. We'll do the first evaluation, not a calculation. So, and we'll see how we're doing. But I will close with one story. We did school district in Indiana, Penn Harris, Madison. 3 years in, I'd forecasted 12,248 students. And they had 12,248 students. Worst thing that ever happened to me. Because ever since then, the board's expected that same level of accuracy. So next year, I'm off by 9. And they just gave me a ton of grief. Like, God, it's a 9% increase in error. We're paying for this? Well, yeah, actually, you are. But, you know, so you're only as good as your last forecast.
I'm sorry, I just have one more question.
Sure.
Do these numbers include the charter schools? The charter schools?
They're in your data?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, these are your students in your schools. Okay.
So the charter schools would not be included?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Because they're not Franklin students.
Yeah.
That's why you'll notice somewhere with it there and add up the 1 through 5 enrollment, and they'll compare it to my population forecast. That's why you'll see that pop number is bigger than your enrollment number, because it includes everybody. That's that whole market share thing we're looking at too. You know that your market share is more than over 100%. A lot of that's also the other schools in there too. So.
Thank you. Just to frame a little bit about next steps, I had shared with the community that we'll have a conversation on March 5th at 7 o'clock at the Horace Mann Cafeteria for anybody in the community who wants to further discuss and know more about the enrollment information. And we are expecting a second report to come from the architect to talk more about the building capacity so that we have all of the information. So that's a second piece that I'm expecting in kind of the April timeframe. This information was shared with the architect, so they're using this enrollment forecast in their analysis.
All right, I think.
This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but I can't do it alone. I can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like this, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. and I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is entitled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.